Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Peter Thompson, and I'm from Minneapolis.
I'm a retired lawyer. And we've been talking the last 2 weeks about war and peace, and in addition, some various legal issues that arise in terms of those sorts of things. And we talked a little bit about a couple sessions ago. I'd like you just to kind of have a couple of these ideas in mind. This is my stepdaughter, should I use her? Keita, we've got a little conspiracy here. You might have seen the baby. That's her baby, and my wife and Keita and I are all teaching this week. So we all came up together, and of course that makes Ricky really happy because then she can hang out with the baby a lot. Which is a wonderful nonviolent activity.
It never occurs to them. They're so honest. But we kind of looked at sort of two ways in this issue of war in responding to the world. And one was Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, that is, you know, war in the service of empire, and the other is Pax Christi. And I want to just do a little review of this. Pax Romana really has as its basis pieties, you know, to duty to the nation and those sort of family things, whereas Pax Christi has its basis in covenant. And the means by which the Peace of Rome gets established, both of these theories are trying to answer the question, how do we come to peace? Because everyone all the time, you know, the people say we fight wars to get to peace, and the other people say, you know, if you fight wars, you never get to peace, and, you know, you have to use other methods. The method here is strength. And the method here in Pax Christi is nonviolence. And we've been looking at nonviolence not only from some of the things Jesus did in Jesus' teachings, but also some of the... Yesterday we looked at, after some of the teachings of Jesus, we looked at Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and then Barbara Deming. We'll put together some of those things. And so the specific in Pax Romana, that is the power of empire, way to apply this strength is through war. And the specific way Pax Christi applies nonviolence is through love. And the result of this in Pax Romana is their definition of peace, which is order. Or control.
Peter, what's that first word in that column?
Piety. You know,
yeah, right.
And the idea of Pax Christi, where we get answer the question of how do we get to peace, and what their idea of peace is the beloved community. So, if you want to boil all this down, these different theories of how we get to peace, to one word, which it's always nice because it's hard to remember too many words. I boil this one down to say domination. And I boil this one down to say relationship. So, kind of keep that in mind. And so we've been talking about nonviolence, as an alternative to war and some of the theories. And then specifically, we've gotten down to talking about civil disobedience, which might contain many of the different strategies of nonviolence that we talked about.
because it might be demonstrations, civil disobedience, it might be marches, it might be petitions, it might be, you know, breaking a law, it might be taking actions. We had one action someone said in one of the sessions, it was last week, they said in Liberia, they'd been having these horrible civil wars, very violent. And I ended up representing a lot of refugees from Liberia, so I heard a lot of those stories. But I'd never heard this one. But the parties were meeting. It was some like governmental function. They were trying to have negotiations and decide how they could end this war. So many of the people have been dying. And the only problem is it was in like a courthouse or a government building, and everyone in there was a man from these various warring factions and political groups and things like that. And the women had been losing all their husbands and sons and some of their daughters and were excluded. It was a very patriarchal society. And they were, to use the vernacular, pissed off. And they couldn't get into the room, and they kept asking and they kept doing things, and nothing seemed to work to get them into the room. So finally, this one woman, she actually came up here. She was one of the leaders. She came up here and gave some talks a few years ago. Decided that what they were going to do to get in the room. Jim, do you remember?
No, I forgot. That was...
She was amazing, powerful.
Yeah, she was.
And here's an idea of power that doesn't need to be violent. And they secured the power by stripping themselves. So all these women stood in front of the room with all their clothes off. And no longer could the men ignore them, because they'd been talking to them and telling them to go home and forget about it, stuff like that. They finally came out. You know, they were so embarrassed. It was going to be on the news and everything. They said, please, well, you can come in the room if you put your clothes on. And so they finally got to be part of the thing. And you know, if you think back to Walter Wink's teaching, which we mentioned last week, about, you know, if they ask for your... give them your cloak also. That's, it's the same dynamic. Now, I don't know if those people read Wink.
All they had was a cloak in those days.
Yeah, or studied that, but it was the same thing. You know, seizing power by an initiative, nonviolently giving away your clothes.
How about naked truth?
It gets to be that way, doesn't it? That's very good.
Well, Africans aren't as inhibited as we are about being naked.
Probably.
I don't think.
But the men didn't want those women standing there naked.
No,
so, anyhow, so these means are generally, you know, I like to characterize as domination. These means from relationship. And if you kind of keep these ideas in mind, as we go through, what I'm going to spend most of the time today is telling you just a fascinating story. It's so multifaceted, it'll take quite a while. I have a couple pictures to go along with it. And I had the amazing privilege to be along personally on a lot of this story. But bits and pieces, of course, I learned from people when I wasn't present. But I was along on the legal part of the story. That is Father Roy Bourgeois' life and witness out of what I'm convinced is love and nonviolent means to try and establish relationship to move us from a system of domination to one where we care about, in this case, the other, particularly the poor and marginalized in Latin America.
Will you write his last name on the board?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to put it up on a slide, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I think I typed it right in the slide, so we should be okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about him?
I will. I'm going to tell you a lot about him.
I never heard of him.
Yeah, but before we get there, I want you to have this in mind and two other things in mind. We talked about Gandhi yesterday, and Gandhi was one of the most brilliant and most creative practitioners of nonviolence. In fact, who was here for the Monday night session when we had Reinhold Niebuhr here? This is really an interesting thing. Remember when Niebuhr talked about Obama's decision to send the 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, he's pretty much a realist and said, you know, the world doesn't really work in idealism, and so even though it was unfortunate and perhaps sinful, it was the kind of thing that, you know, must be done. Here's a great irony. The reason King got so interested in Gandhi I found out this morning, was Niebuhr. Niebuhr was reading Gandhi, and he read all about it, and then he wrote a big article, and he said, I don't think nonviolence is going to work in a lot of situations. India was a very unique situation, and Gandhi made it work there, and although, you know, I'm a detractor of nonviolence in most situations. And then he just put on a little parenthetical and says, however, it might work in the civil rights movement.
Whoa.
King picked up that article. And that's how he thought about Gandhi. King then went to India and studied Gandhi. You know, he went there for several weeks and beforehand read all about and put those principles into action in a more effective way than probably anyone had in a tremendous movement that ended up in the Civil Rights Act of 1968 and the denting of racism in the United States, which of course still exists, but as the process goes on, I think we've made tremendous progress. So, from this genius in nonviolence, I would like Deborah to read very carefully and very loudly a paragraph when he talks about some of the parts of nonviolence, and as you hear it, think about what you're hearing here in terms of, you know, some of these words. Thanks, Deborah.
Nonviolence is not a resignation from all real fighting against wickedness. On the contrary, the nonviolence of my conception is a more active and real fight against wickedness than retaliation, whose very nature is to increase wickedness. I contemplate a mental and therefore a moral opposition to immorality. I seek entirely to blunt the edge of the tyrant's sword, not by putting up against it a sharper edged weapon, but by disappointing his expectation that I would be offering physical resistance. The resistance of the soul that I should offer would elude him. It would at first dazzle him, and at last compel recognition from him, which recognition would not humiliate, but would uplift him. It may be urged that this is an ideal state, and so it is.
So the wonderful part about that whole transition is that at the end, it uplifts him, you know, it puts you in the relationship. A couple other things to keep in mind before we start going through School of the Americas. Couple other quotes, one by Berrigan and one by someone else. I'll come back to that in a minute. This is a statement by, I think, Andrew McThenia, who's a Christian lawyer who has been involved in many of these movements. So I just want you to read that. And you know, this happens.
It does.
One of my clients. One of my clients, Charlie Litke, who's a former priest, he was involved in one of these cases. He said, you know, that the movement doesn't end when you go to jail for the time you're in jail and then you get out. And he said when he got to the maximum security federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, people sit around and they talk about, you know, what they're in for and all that kind of stuff. And he would be quiet, very charismatic person, and they'd ask him. And he would explain to them why he was there. And these guys were like, You mean you want to be here? You know, tell us more about that. And so, you know, understanding all that's a tremendous spread. Some of the sisters from School of the Americas went to Pekin, Illinois. As soon as they got in there, they found many of the young women at the women's prison were African-American, were poor, and a lot of them had been runners for their boyfriends who were drug dealers. And they, because they wouldn't snitch on their boyfriends, they would get 10-year sentences for their first offense. And so these nuns immediately started challenging the legality of their convictions, the terms of their imprisonment, the kinds of things they could put together for them when they got to the outside. And so, you know, their mission continued on. Another anecdote. I went down to Columbus, Georgia, where the School of the Americas case was, for like 10 years. The first couple of years we went down, we couldn't say what we were doing because we couldn't find a, no one would rent us a room then. You know, they thought we were pariahs. Toward the end, I was riding down in a limo from Atlanta to Columbus, and by then, we were kind of well known, and they actually enjoyed it because, you know, 10,000-15,000 people would show up every year, and the community was making a lot of money. They thought it was good business. And so the driver said, "What are you doing down there?" And I explained it to him, and he says, "You know," he said, "last year I was driving down there, and I had a bunch of nuns in my car that were going to the protest, and I told them it was my birthday, and they sang me happy birthday." And he said, "Then later, I read that they sent this one who was 80-something for 6 months to federal prison." He says, "I don't know all the details, but I'm sure that what's going on in there ain't right." That was enough information for him. So, you know, the mission spreads through relationship. And here's an interesting statement by Father Berrigan, who spent a lot of time in federal prison opposing the war. And,
Which war? Vietnam.
Vietnam. Yeah. He did some of those plowshares actions where they would, you know, they would go into the missile silos, they would hammer on the missile silos, make some dents in it as a symbolic act to hammer our swords into the plowshares. And he really calls it a religious act, a liturgical act, an act of witness. Because, you know, it was his belief in some of the things we've talked about in the past and mentioned today about Jesus, that that is what it was. You know, that's what that act is. So, and then lastly, as we go through some of the talk about the School of the Americas and what it was and what Father Bourgeois has done and the movement he's built. It's still open, still spending millions of dollars of your taxpayers' money to train Latin American soldiers to go back down to their countries. And
they're still doing that?
Yeah.
They kill people.
And they're not at war with other countries. They're at war with, you know, the labor unions, the human rights leaders, the religious. It's still open. They missed by 10 votes with Congress last year. So all they need is a little more push, Karen.
Okay.
It's
called something else now. It's called...
Yes. Western Hemispheric Institute of Security and... I think they changed the name in 2001 just because everyone would say, you know, hey, hey, ho, ho, the SOA has got to go. And and we couldn't say that in marches when it was... Western Hemispheric Institute for Security and Global
Something.
Yeah, exactly. So here's what we talked about yesterday, and we're not going to go through it all again, but when we think about different disobedience we'll talk about today, etc., think about and don't be afraid to bring up and talk about, well, what about this? I don't think, you know, property damage, does that really fit nonviolence? And is that respecting the interests of others? And if you had a trial, Thompson, how could you say you were accepting punishment? Those sorts of things. So let's discuss those as we go along. And anytime you've got an anecdote or you remember something that happened or you have a question, please interrupt, because that's the way I like to do it. You know, I like to handle the issues as they come up at the time. Okay, so I want to shrink this. And if we want to look back at that again, you know, those definitions and stuff. Okay, so this is a long story, but it's kind of a fun one, and it's sort of a tragic one. And so if you get, you know, anytime you want to, I'd love to interact, because, you know, like some of the things that were said last night were just wonderful. So when you have something to say, please speak up. Okay, the School of the Americas was the institution. It was founded in 1948, and it was in Panama, and it stayed there till 1984. The president of Panama kicked it out and said it was one of the great destabilizers in Latin America.
So what was going on in 1948?
Well, after the rise of communism and the domino theory and concern that leftist kind of governments would be a threat to the United States. But School of the Americas is one school that started overseas. There are many, many military schools and training grounds around the world. Just as I was reading this morning, a little background just to look, you know, they were saying that there's one in Ecuador. There's one in, there's another country that asked us to get out, Latin American country.
And they're all sponsored by the U.S.
Yes, yeah, I mean, all U.S. Military. So, you know, in a way, this is symbolic, because if we close the Army School of the Americas, they'll put it offshore. Or, and there's, you know, 100 others that will still be operating. But it would at least be some kind of victory. And you may not think it would be a victory. I mean, that, I'm open to people really, you know, raising that up. Okay, so Father Bourgeois was, we call him the Raging Cajun. He's from the New Orleans area. And a lot of this is, you know, his passion, his beliefs, and his rage. Think Jesus with the moneylenders in the temple. So after he graduated from college, Vietnam War was going on. And he volunteered, and he went over, and he was in the Navy, and he was on a ship, and he got a Purple Heart, and after his 6 months was up, he put in for another 6 months, because he wanted to do his duty and fight communism, so he wanted to get in the swamps with a machine gun and kill some of those communists. So
he was a priest then?
Pardon me?
He was a priest then?
He was not. So here's young Roy, just when he became a priest. And so while he was there doing that, he met a Maronite priest in Saigon. And the Maronite priest was running an orphanage from kids. You can imagine how many kids didn't have their parents in the middle of Vietnam. And it also dawned on him that the love that was being given these kids was what was the healing that was necessary, rather than the killing he was doing out in the rice paddies. And so he really got connected with this priest, and when he finished his tour of duty, he enrolled in the Maronite Seminary in New York City. Graduated, became a Maronite priest, and was sent to Bolivia. So he started getting hooked into Latin American events and politics and things like that right away. In Bolivia, he had an assignment working with the poor and began to advocate for them, and got in trouble with the Bolivian government and was persecuted and tortured in Bolivia. After 4 years there, he got out, or perhaps had to leave because of the government.
So, and possibly, what year would that have been?
Well, he was up here in 80, I'd say early 80s.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So right at the height of stuff that was going on down there. So also during this time, you know, he knew a lot of the Catholic priests and nuns who were in different places in Latin America, including a good friend of his who in 1980 was raped and executed along with three other women in El Salvador. And a man that he had met, Oscar Romero, who was similarly executed in 1980. So Roy started studying these events, and he determined that most of the perpetrators of the rape and murder of his friend and of the assassination of Romero were trained at the Army School of the Americas. So he started, you know, looking into the facts and figures and things about the Army School of the Americas. He then came up to Minnesota, hence I got the good luck to meet him. And in 1989, on November 16th, was an event which really changed his life. That was, Sarah, you nodded. Do you know what happened that night?
That's when the priest and the housekeeper were killed in San Salvador.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So a group from the Actal Battalion came out. It was sort of almost open revolution in San Salvador then, and they blamed the priests, the Jesuit priests, who were at San Salvador University for being the ideological leaders of the guerrillas because, you know, their kinds of preaching, sort of preaching you hear up here at Holden about supporting the poor and marginalized. And so they went and they dragged the priests and their housekeeper and her daughter out in the front lawn and executed them by shooting them in the back of the head. Jim Barnett was in the area. He is a Dominican priest and was friends of several of those people. He's a friend of mine. And he went out that night and scooped up from behind one of their heads some of the blood-soaked soil as a relic of the martyrs and saved that blood-soaked soil. This is going to kind of come back in the trial. So that day, Roy Bourgeois was furious. He was raging. And much like Jesus with the people changing money in the temples. He was in Minneapolis at the time, and I read about it the day after in our newspaper. That night, he went to a reception for a law firm in Minnesota. That law firm was representing the Arena Party in their lobbying work in Congress. The Arena Party was the so-called Death Squad Party that was in control in El Salvador and was responsible for a lot of the paramilitary and military actions which led to a lot of these deaths. And so this Minneapolis law firm, which is a very big, prestigious law firm, was having an open house at Hubert Humphrey International School. And because they were representing the Arena Party, you know, he wanted to call that to people's attention. So he came in and he was furious and he gave a speech to the people, and he said after he gave the speech, they went back to eating brie and sipping on their Chablis, and that made him madder. And so he said, don't you understand, the people you're representing are killing innocents in El Salvador. You know, my brothers yesterday, and they continued to ignore him. So he went over to the table, and he picked up the shrimp dip, which is in a great big tureen. I know all the details because we had a trial. And he poured the shrimp out on the floor. And they called the university police and came and arrested him and, you know, charged him with making a mess, destruction of property, you know. Those sorts of things. Right. Spilling shrimp. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so we had a trial. And I got to know him and we talked. And you remember one of the things on civil disobedience says acceptance of responsibility? Mm-hmm. Okay. If we had a trial, therefore pleaded not guilty, and had a trial in front of a jury, how could we say that was accepting responsibility rather than just pleading guilty and taking the consequence? Any creative ideas?
That could be guilty of the charges against.
Again?
Well, if you're charged with something and you don't feel it's a fair charge, you plead not guilty to that charge. It doesn't mean that you're denying responsibility for the act, you're denying responsibility for the charge against you.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and basically, Roy looked at this as an opportunity. He would never contest the facts and would never even want to put them to the proof of the facts. He would admit the facts. Oftentimes in trials, we would stipulate to facts, which means the prosecution and the defense agree to the facts. They type out the facts, read them to the jury. So they didn't even have to call any witnesses. But then he would testify as to his reasons for doing so. Now, and he viewed this as a teachable moment in terms of being in relationship with the 12 people in the box, the judge, the jury, the people in the courtroom, all that sort of stuff. So in this particular case, we made a lot of motions and we had all sorts of discussions. And I know the judge was a good Catholic because I know him. His name is Duffy. And he dismissed the charge before the prosecution could, you know, get to the jury. And I remember after he did it, I said, well, Father Bourgeois wanted to testify, but he can't testify now. So any of the jurors, he would like to, you know, explain to you, you know, why he took this action. And I remember the judge says, all right, well, if any of the jurors are interested, you can go outside and you can talk to the good father. And that's a Catholic phrase. And because Father Bourgeois told me, he says, oh, yeah, I could tell he was a good Catholic because he called me
a good father.
That was much different than things Judge Elliott called him down in Columbus, Georgia. And I'll get to that in a minute. So the reason the School of the Americas Watch has a vigil in Columbus, Georgia in November every year, because that's the anniversary when the Jesuits were murdered. And about a year later, here's a newsletter from the School of the Americas Watch. So about a year later, Roy said to me, Peter, I want to walk around Lake of the Isles with you. And I thought, okay, that's great. So we walked around Lake of the Isles. And he says, I'm going to Columbus, Georgia. And I'm going to stay there until I close that immoral school. And as I go down there, he says, I want you to come down because we're going to have some confrontation with the police. And we want to make sure, you know, we can get set up in a proper manner. And we're not throwing off, you know, our protest site, some things like that. So I said, okay. And they went down there. It was about 15 of them. They're former FBI agents, vets for peace people. Kathy Kelly, who's been a famous person in terms of the Iraq War, and Charlie Litke, who I mentioned, and Roy rented an apartment right at the gates of Fort Benning. Okay, he couldn't legally go on Fort Benning because in 1983, when he first came back to this country, he went down to Fort Benning, snuck onto the base in military gear, saw Salvadoran soldiers being trained there. So he took a cassette tape back then and put it in a boombox. And at night, he got some climbing gear that the deer hunters use, and he climbed up one of the pine trees down there, like 180 feet in the air. Pines really grow high. So he got up there right by the barracks where the Salvadoran soldiers were staying, and he turned on full volume Oscar Romero's Last Homily, where Romero asked the soldiers to lay down your guns and to stop killing the people. And of course, all the Salvadoran soldiers are Catholics, and here's the Archbishop, basically telling them that.
Whoa.
So the military police were summoned, and one of them climbed up the tree and took away the box, and, you know, they were really scared. Roy is a very physically capable man. Very strong, very coordinated, very charismatic guy. So he came down and he was dragged before Judge Elliott, who
is... How much of the speech did he get to play?
A lot.
It took a while.
Oh, it took forever. He played that speech, you know, for hours. It just was on a revolving. He kept playing it and playing it.
Wow.
So he was brought into federal court for illegally going on to Fort Benning base. And the judge in that case treated him like dirt, not like good father. In fact, when they would call other witnesses at that trial, they called some other witnesses who were religious people attached to the base. He would call them reverend, and whenever he would refer to Father Bourgeois, he'd call them defendant. So anyhow, it appeared from the transcript of that trial in 1983 that Judge Elliott was biased against Father Roy Bourgeois. Elliott had a record, I don't know if he's still alive, he's very old if he is, of being a racist and very favorable toward the army. There's lots of stories about him. He was voted by lawyers in the United States the worst federal judge in the United States.
Oh my gosh.
He didn't have a law clerk. You have law clerks, you can look at the law for you.
You have what?
He didn't have a law clerk. He just did the way he
clerk.
Wanted to.
Oh,
he yeah. So anyhow, I had this transcript. So in 1989, I went down there. They got settled. There was about 15, 20 of them. And they were on a hunger fast, water-only hunger fast, and some of them made it to 35 days, including Roy Bourgeois. At the end of that 35 days, by then, I was back in Minneapolis in my law office, and I got a call, and it was from Roy, and he says, well, Peter, we need to come back down here because we're going to have a trial. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, Father Jim Barnett, remember that name? Had the blood-soaked soil of the martyrs. And we had a registered nurse come out, and we each gave like a pint of blood, and we mixed it with the blood-soaked soil. And then we put it, three of us, Charlie Litke, Pat Litke, and Roy Bourgeois, decided they were going to do this action, in like squeezable little nurse baby bottles, nursing bottles kind of things. And filled them up, called the TV stations, remember openly, and said, we're going down to the School of the Americas, which is a big building on this huge...
Inside Fort Benning?
Yeah. Fort Benning is like the size of a county. Mm-hmm. It's the largest infantry training base in the country. And the School of the Americas is there, and the Latin American soldiers go to the various, you know, rifle ranges and all that kind of stuff, get their training. So they went down to School of the Americas, and they went into a place called the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame had pictures of various Latin American soldiers.
Excuse me, how did they get in there?
It's open.
Oh.
They walked in the door. Okay. He was trespassing because he had been ordered off the base. The other two weren't at the time, but obviously weren't, you know, invited to do what they're doing. So they each had a baby bottle of their own blood and the blood of the martyrs mixed, which they viewed as a relic which could make things sacred. And so they walked into this place, which they viewed as evil, and shot their blood around on the pictures in the Hall of Shame. And some of the pictures on the Hall of Shame were Manuel Noriega, who was a strong man from Panama, who was a graduate of the School of the Americas, committed all sorts of human rights abuses. They call it the Hall of Fame. These people call it the Hall of Shame, and that they were trying to purify this area. Roberto Diabusin, who was the head of the Arena Party in El Salvador, graduate of the Army School of the Americas. Hugo Banzer, the dictator of Bolivia, who was a graduate of the Army School of the Americas. And top people from Peru, Guatemala, and other places, all of whom had terrible records as dictators or chiefs of the army in their countries and had graduated from the Army School of the Americas. So they squirted this blood around, and then the MPs came and arrested them and put them in custody. So we had a trial. And
So in this case, two of the things I want to kind of get your reaction to is there's property damage, you know, because they had to come and clean up the pictures and replace some of the carpeting because of the blood. And there's, again, a not guilty plea and a jury trial. And if you remember back to our criteria for civil disobedience, it was to be done openly, conscientiously, acceptance of punishment, nonviolently. And so would you call that a violation of the requirement of nonviolence?
What were they charged with?
They were charged with destruction of government property. Or I think sometimes they call it deprecation of government property. You know, damage to property.
How did they plead not guilty?
Why did they?
How can they plead not guilty?
Well, you can always plead not guilty, as this gentleman said. You might want to give that another whirl. It's good.
So you're pleading not guilty to what you're being charged with. It doesn't say that you're not accepting responsibility for a different charge or a different interpretation of the charge that's against.
But they're obviously...
You're starting to build your case by saying that the mixture of blood of the participants with blood of these people that are executed made it, I think you said, holy.
Yes, right. A relic.
A relic, yeah.
Yeah. Any Catholics in here? Mm-hmm. Tell us about relics. Those guys had to explain it to me because I didn't really.
I have no idea.
It's like a piece of the cross or a piece of Jesus' cloak or something like
that. Part of a saint.
Part of the
body.
Thorns
made
of thorns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Or a piece of Saint Stephen.
and so the idea, I think, would be that this sacred fluid in conjunction with these evil situations could help take away the evil, help make this place sacred also.
So
probably
doing the opposite of what the charges.
There you go. There's their answer to why they could plead not guilty.
I didn't hear it.
Say it again.
Well, they're making what is already desecrated sacred. They're doing the reverse of what the charge is.
The charge was making it evil, dirty, rotten, damaged.
Desecrated.
Yeah, desecrated, and they're doing the opposite.
Sanctifying.
So you can see it's a stretch because it's obvious they did the acts. And so you've got to find a way to have it actually be an issue in the case. And when they say with intent to deprecate government property, when Roy would be on the stand, I would say, did you intend to deprecate government property? And he'd say, no, I intended to make it holy.
Wow.
Now, in the world of, you know, law and courts, Elliot got real mad at us, of course. And the jury can kind of tell that, and he was going after people. Like Charlie Litke was on the stand, a co-defendant, and I asked him, I said, you know, why did you do this? And he says, well, I need to explain that. I need to tell you something about myself. And he said, when I was in Vietnam, and Judge Elliot, who was asleep, on his big chair, you know, with the wheels on it. He was about this far away from us. Look, he was over there. All of a sudden, he heard Vietnam, and he slid his chair all the way over there. And he says, we'll hear no more about Vietnam. And Charlie Litke looked at him. He says, well, you know, I think this trial is about why I was there and who I am. And Vietnam was a huge part about why I was there. So I'd like, and then he grabbed the indictment, he put it down, he says, this shows who you are right here. You're the defendant. That's who you are. And that's what we care about. And we'll hear no more about Vietnam. In the thick southern accent, you know. And so actually that was a thing. I went through that little story. I just told about Elliot, only I didn't say he was asleep, in the U.S. Supreme Court.
2 years later, when we were contesting the judges sitting on the case at all because of his earlier, you know, biased performance in 1983. So at any rate, then when Father Bourgeois' testimony got over, the prosecutor said, "You mean to tell me when you were squirting blood on one of these photos on the wall, you didn't think it was going to do damage?" That's a very good question. See, because he was getting right back, you know, to just the simple act, not all of this intentional, you know, state of mind and all that kind of thing. And Father Bourgeois gave, I thought, a very good answer to a very hard question. It was a good prosecutor. Pete Paterman from Tennessee. We respected each other. We could hardly understand each other. One time I got up and objected during the middle of the trial, and I thought he'd said something that he hadn't said, which was unobjectionable. And then when that got explained, Judge Elliott, in one of the few nice moments, he says, "See here, the North and the South still can't get along." So what Father Bourgeois said is, he said, what I was thinking about was not a picture or some wallpaper. I was thinking about Selena, the 15-year-old who was shot in the back of the head. So that's how it goes. And Elliot really ramrodded the case pretty much. We had a thin chance with the jury to start with. But the whole idea of having the trial also is, you know, it was in the newspapers every day. You know, widely. It was, you know, in later years, as the trials became more infamous, you know, a lot of the news would go nationwide. And so, as remember yesterday, Barbara Deming says, you might, you know, lose a small portion of the population as to what you're saying, but you may leapfrog over them and reach thousands more who are sympathetic. And so, strategically, what you have to do is consider, you know, is this in all regards a good thing or a bad thing to bring the kind of systemic change you want to bring in society. So, that was 1991, that trial. Then they started having the annual event. And in terms of our civil disobedience, I would say what Roy did that year, he's a man of incredible faith. He got 18 months in prison for that. A man of incredible faith, but also very smart. Because after that, the people started flooding to Columbus, Georgia. Every year, you know, there's like 20,000, I think, last year. And the movement to get Congress to stop the appropriation is getting closer and closer. He never went that far again in one of his actions. The next time he went to prison, he simply walked over the line, like Ricky talked about doing yesterday. You know, you walk over the line and you're trespassing on the grounds, and, you know, he pled guilty and you got the maximum, 6 months. It was just a misdemeanor. And so as, you know, the momentum built, he didn't need to do such things to cause as much of a stir and as much publicity, because basically, you know, he's kept his eye on the prize the whole time. He wants to close the School of the Americas. And it's interesting. In fact, we were talking about the nuns case yesterday. Remember? A couple of you were asking me about it this morning. You know, the nuns went in about 4 years later and peeled the words School of the Americas off the sign at the front gate. It says Fort Benning, it says School of Americas, and they went in with crowbars, and they took School of Americas off, and they hung up a sign that said School of Assassins. Well, when they did that, Roy was a little upset because of the property damage, because the movement was to a point then where he felt they really didn't need to do property damage, you know, to keep things moving. They felt differently, and they are, you know, women of their own mind, and so they thought they felt called to do that.
How much attention did their story get?
A lot down then, because all the stories then are getting quite a bit. There's six went to prison this year. I did it
I was the lawyer for all of them until I moved to Holden in 2001. Since then, a lawyer from Loyola University in New Orleans has taken over the cases. And there's a lot of publicity now. So here's a picture from one of the early years. Remember what Berrigan said about liturgy? This event is unlike any protest you've ever been to. Saturday, it's a big rally. Everyone comes, and there's people for as far as you can see, and they have speakers, they have victims of torture, they have relatives of people who have been killed by the School of America's graduates, they have movie stars, they have all sorts of people come and give talks, which is just like a big old demonstration, you know, and everyone, Pete Seeger's playing his banjo, and people are cheering and singing and all this stuff. The next day, on Sunday, it is liturgy. Everyone who wants to gets a cross with the name of one of the victims of the graduates of the School of the Americas and are in a solemn procession and walk slowly toward the school. And as the names of those who are victims is read, have you been there, Sarah?
Yes.
Why don't you describe what happens? It's really a moving...
On Sunday?
Yeah.
Everyone has a cross in the name of a victim. It could be, it was El Salvador, Guatemala, Colombia, various countries. Often they were children. Mm-hmm. And lately, of course, it's been a lot of Colombians. Mm-hmm. And then it's a very, very well organized procession, and you've got 20,000 people. Mm-hmm. And at the front, at the gate of the fence, which I think they removed the gate and put up a barrier, basically, is what they had done, the army, there is a platform, because that's where all the music and the speeches and everything come down. On that day, each name is read, and with the drum. And I mean, it's read song, you know, sort of in a chant. And then the drum comes down. And groups are people, they're individuals, they're often groups, often high school students, often college students, often people our age and older, people with uniforms on, who leave their uniforms on the get out of the barrier that had been participated in World War II or in Vietnam or Korea or one of those. They leave their uniforms, so there are veterans for peace that do those sort of things. And then you leave your cross. You put your cross in the fence so that when the whole thing is over, this whole fence is all crosses and flowers and uniforms and names and, you know, people put various things up there. And, oh, there at the beginning of the session is Father Bourgeois, but there's also a pantomime group that dress all in the black with the white faces, pantomime, and carrying, yes, there I am. And they begin the whole thing, and then when they get down there, they lay down and just stay there. There's one man, I think you have a picture of the man that just stands there, he's all in white, and he never moves for a moment, I don't know what happened.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway, he doesn't move at all, you just see him. And he's standing there, and it's all, has a group that rehearses. And there's all the plan of organizing of how you walk up, that you cross, you walk on that. You got a lot of people that were doing that. You know, and then they go to the back and people keep coming up again, it's well organized. And then at the end, there's this kind of quiet, people are milling around a little bit. Then there is the great big puppet festival parade because you celebrate life.
You can see one of the puppets here.
No.
See that?
Oh, there are these puppets.
Yeah, these big, huge puppets.
Mm-hmm. And it's very quiet. It's a
very quiet procession, all ages, little children. You know, the whole thing is the most amazing thing I've ever participated.
And people are, some of the people are in religious garb. Some of them carry signs that their church is there. You know, have various groups. And when they read every name, remember what they say, and everyone holds their cross up?
Presente.
Yeah. What's presente mean?
Present.
Present. Although dead.
It's
present in spirit. Yeah, so it's a very, very moving thing. Here's an idea of the, you know, group of people that are gathered. People stay off the lawns, and they're very well behaved, and, you know, it's completely.
So they can't give them any reason to be arrested. They're not disturbing the peace.
They get permits and everything. Mm-hmm. And there are a few people. Here is Susan Sarandon and Sister Jean Prejean, Dead Man Walking. who's the guy on West Wing? Martin Sheen?
Yeah.
He was there and gave a speech several years. it was kind of funny. One year, he made a great comment, though. It was when Bush Gore couldn't decide who was president, and it was in the Supreme Court, so there wasn't a president for a little while. And he says, well, okay, I am president now because no one else is. And I declare this goal of America's closed.
If he'd been on a ballot, I swear he would have won in Washington.
That's probably true.
I know he would. I would have voted for him.
So that's, you know, exact signs. Now you can see how, you know, civil disobedience can be a liturgical act. You know, it can be really a witness of Christ-like behavior.
So it takes something like, was it the blood spurting that really started this? Really.
Yep.
Yeah. It takes something dramatic that can be on the national media.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I keep wondering, how in the heck can we organize that kind of protest against what's happening now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I say we. I mean, I would join it.
Well, they're 10 votes short in the House, and then they have to get it past the Senate to block the appropriation.
Or,
for the School of Americas.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the war.
Yeah.
Afghanistan, the whole situation, everything is happening.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about this is that Father Bourgeois has seized on this, you know, target.
Yeah.
And so people down there are talking about the same thing you're talking about.
How do we spread?
Well, there's a basic, though, isn't it? Basic to the whole thing?
It is basic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you got that close, it might make a big change on all this other.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get Congress to do something. I mean, basically, you know, they move slowly. They're afraid to do anything that would, you know, get them voted out of office.
It might be worse after the next elections.
Yeah, it could. So, to have a victory and to see this is a model for use of civil disobedience and calling for nonviolence would be a very... It would be a celebratory event. And then we'd have to reorganize and start with something... You know.
But I don't remember seeing anything. I was already on a Holden by 80 and watching the news on TV. I don't remember ever seeing that being covered.
I've seen it.
Not this. I've never seen that.
Not that.
And I read all the time.
But we did read about the blood, though. We
really?
Read about
well,
that, but I didn't know the details of it. We thought it was their blood. We didn't know anything about the martyr's blood being connected with it. That I never read that.
Yeah, you probably have to been in the courtroom.
But why doesn't the press cover that?
Oh, yeah. That's a question.
Yeah. Who knows?
It's a cell.
Have you ever seen the picture of the 15 nuns? A friend of mine, and we have a breakfast, a bunch of religious women, only we're not. And anyway, she brings in this picture of nuns. There's 15 nuns, and they've all got guns. And she said, it says at the bottom, these are the 15 virgins waiting for the ones that kill themselves, martyr themselves, for the 15 virgins, and that's who's waiting. 15 nuns with guns.
You know, I just saw Sound of Music again in Love of Ruth, and one of the great lines for the sisters at the beginning of the show, they're discussing the apostolate,
and Sister Ermengarde is way too pious. The religious life is not for the pious.
Yeah, and then we'll close with prayer.
Someone, when they were mentioning this liturgy about how the gate is now a barrier, one thing that seems to be happening more and more is that the other side, or the people in power, are recognizing the potential for civil disobedience. And the barriers are becoming wider and wider. We were living in D.C. during the World Trade talks or whatever was going on, and we weren't part of that, but people who wanted to disagree and wanted to do civil disobedience, that you couldn't get anywhere near what was going on. And it makes me wonder how anyone who's thinking about civil disobedience is going to have to shift their thinking of what are the strategies going to be in the future, because the other side is getting very savvy to people being able to get through and try to do
it. Yeah, so there's a fear of the power of civil disobedience.
Oh, yeah. And mightn't that be a fear of terrorism, for example, rather than civil disobedience here? Well,
it could be. That's
I would think that would be why they're here.
Yeah, that's what they say. Like at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul a couple of years ago, that's what they said. There was fear of terrorism. And so we, as we marched, we couldn't get near the delegates or, you know, the people that were meeting. So it's kind of, you know, where you're coming from, and you can look at it either way. But there definitely is fear on both sides. Pardon me?
It might be some of both.
Could be, yeah. I didn't see any terrorists in St. Paul.
No, no. But they didn't see the ones in New York either.
Yeah.
The trade centers.
Okay, should we close in prayer? God of all ages and times, we give you thanks for your presence among us. We thank you for creating us in your image, binding us together as one human family. Open our eyes so that we may see your face in all those around us. Strengthen us so that we may reflect your wisdom in all that we say and do.
Amen. Thank you.